You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is Wednesday, the 15th of December, 2021. Again, I thank all of my donors. You guys have really made yet another very difficult year slightly easier. We live in an age of media manipulation. When I say media, I'm not just talking about news or newspapers. I'm talking about textbook publishing and every other aspect of communication, where there are those who pretend to be intellectuals, pontificate on a topic, and over time, myths and stories masquerade as facts and truth. And I've dealt with this topic before. But I was asked in an interview recently about Rasputin and the relevance to the murder of Tsar Nicholas. Of course, this has been a topic, you know, a major topic of mine for a very long time. And I have an entire book out on this topic, which I published for the 100th anniversary a few years ago of the murder of the royal family. I was also at a dinner recently where I signed this very book, and was asked about it. Rasputin continues to come up. He continues to fascinate people. And I want to set it straight one more time. At the time in Russia, it's very difficult to attack Nicholas II directly. You had a very prosperous economy. He was a personally very popular man. And he had guided the country through this transition into a modern, you call it essentially a yeoman, a representative government based on the yeomanry. The peasantry owned about 90% of the Russian land at the time. And any redemption payments from serfdom had been canceled, which of course a monarch can do. It's extremely difficult to attack Tsar Nicholas. And one way to attack him indirectly was to attack those around him. Johnson's law mattered back then, too. You take someone who no one knows anything about, and then you can invent whatever you want about him, and that person was Rasputin. Rasputin has been treated in every possible media, every possible kind of entertainment and music and everything else, and not a shred of anything about this is true. The man never even had a bank account. The man had no wealth whatsoever. He was never a member of any sect or any cult. There really was nothing obviously wrong with the man. I've mentioned before that under the Kerensky government, the provisional state convened what's called the Emergency Investigation Committee for the misuses of former ministers and other chief executives. That's the long version of the name. And the documents still exist, of course, and historians very rarely use it. They very rarely go to it. And of course, there's good reason for this, because the point of this, what we call the EIC, the Emergency Committee, the Emergency Investigation Committee, was to uncover the crimes and alleged corruption of the Tsarist administration, including Rasputin, and people around him, including Rasputin. And of course, they found absolutely nothing. The assumption, you know, the general condition of the Russian state, as Nicholas allegedly fell from power, should be kept in mind. I mentioned this as well. Most American academics, using, you know, like Hans Kohn uses a phrase, unbelievable corruption, which is strictly Bolshevik propaganda. This committee says that there was no such entity. See, Kerensky and the Masonic lodges of Russia and Europe were trying to vindicate themselves. They were trying to justify their own revolution. And they figured by creating this committee, they would create the grounds for their own rule. They would create the philosophical foundation that would justify themselves. And they failed. And at the least, you can call them honest. The Deputy Minister of the Interior under Nicholas Viagurko says this. He says, the integrity of the overwhelming majority of the high officials is beyond question. Only persons who are absolutely unfair can now accuse our high officials of graft, for all our state archives have been opened and all secret documents have been published. The provisional government, and later the Bolsheviks, conducted the most exhaustive inquiries into the activities of our ministers and were unable to detect one compromising fact. And you would think, of course, that some of this would penetrate into modern scholarship, and it's not. There's so many of the biographies of Tsar Nicholas which are disastrous. Pharaoh, Cohn, all of these, who refused to even mention this. And you can't take any modern work on Nicholas as professional, because for this very reason. These are, as I say, crude attempts to exonerate the Bolsheviks, as well as to bolster their own respectability in academia. The committee admits, and I've written this many places, that there was no corruption, whether it be Rasputin or anyone else. The revolutionaries found little corruption in Tsar Nicholas's administration. They had every incentive to justify their revolution. And at least, honestly, they discovered nothing. And then it was swept under the rug. I mean, the EIC was made up of those who were spreading rumors to the revolutionary groups and to the population at large just a few years before it was convened. They were spreading rumors that Rasputin, was pro-German, was dominating foreign policy, was the cause of any problems during the war. And of course, he wasn't pro-German. He had no influence over foreign policy. Tsar Nicholas II explicitly and very vehemently demanded an investigation into Rasputin so that he wouldn't be taken in by a fraud. And no evidence of wrongdoing was found even there. This was long before anything happened. And the High Commission, this is under the seal of the Attorney General, V.I. Rudnev, says this. This testimonial delivered to Mikhail Libikov certifies that not a single indication of Gregory Rasputin's political activity was disclosed by the High Commission of Inquiry. The inquiry into the influence of Rasputin and the imperial family was intensive, but it was definitively established. That influence had its source only in the profound religious sentiment of their majesties. The only favor Rasputin accepted was a rental of his lodging paid by the personal chancellor of his majesty. He accepted presents made by the hands of the imperial family, shirts, waistbands, whatever, that Rasputin had no connection with any foreign authorities. That all pamphlets and newspaper articles on the subject of Rasputin's influence and other rumors of gossip were fabricated by the powerful enemies of the emperor. And this statement is given under the signature and seal of the Attorney General of the High Commission. The provisional government had the full access to everything. The so-called abdication of the Tsar in 1917, which did not exist, by the way, he did not abdicate power. They had full access to all of the public and private papers. They had full access to all the Duma documents. There's never been an exhaustive commission like this into the form, behavior, structure, functioning of any royal government. Given the access, not only the access to the documents, but the interest they had in uncovering something. They found no problems with Rasputin, but also the imperial government maintained the highest standards in personal dignity. In 1922, A.F. Romanov, who had no relation to the royal family, in his work on the subject, he said, the extraordinary commission of inquiry Investigator Rudnev made a written statement on the results of the commission's work, which could not find literally anything to compromise Nicholas II and the Empress. And that is, in fact, extraordinary. And the text of the EIC itself, the actual official final report, says, "It turns out that the supreme power in the last months of the whole regime gradually delegated parts of their sovereign rights in the hands of our ministers or senior officials. All of us comrades lived under the old regime. We all knew what was being done. We all think something terrible is happening in the police department. You know, in all fairness, it should be. Not as it is in depraved imagination. A document which is the Magna Carta of the police department as to its lawlessness. This document is called the Instruction on the Organization and Conduct of Internal Supervision of the Gendarme and Investigative Offices. Entire generations gave themselves to the police, had a hand in the creation of this manual. All of them gradually perfect this system." Which means, of course, that they found absolutely nothing in the police department worthy of legal prosecution. It's true. The Bolsheviks were less interested in the truth than the white government was. But this is what they found. It also suggests, of course, that the new government didn't trust the ramblings of the media, distasteful as it was. But it's an admission, even though it had revolutionary jargon, all over it, that they were incorrect. And it's kept out of a history textbook on purpose. This inquiry of the revolutionary government showed absolutely nothing. Even Rudnev says this. He says, "We began our committee's work. Perhaps you would join in this respect and say that we were right. At this point of view, we consider as a whole to grasp a general picture of the past months and years of the fallen regime. This is from a certain point of view. We conducted extensive investigative work. The other part of our commission is engaged in the actionability of these crimes, namely, to gather the evidence objectively so as to detail the offenses committed by officials as to whether they came under criminal law. Those crimes they have committed are to be punished. If you pay attention only to the concluding lines of future indictments, be the usual abuse of power and the overexertion of state authority, and that conclusion, my comrades, would be false." Now, I've written before, I've said before, and I'll say it again. The entire history of this era has to be rewritten. Just from that alone, the so-called facts of the corruption, Rasputin, the government ministers, bureaucrats, whatever. Nothing you read about this era is true. And it shouldn't be surprising. Tsar Nicholas was personally impeccable, which is typical of many monarchs who were properly raised. His personal stamp is everywhere in the governing structure of the government. Remember, the government in St. Petersburg was small relative to Europe, especially given the size of the country. The number of bureaucrats was fairly small, and the duties for each office was very well delineated. It was professional. It was ranked according to military ascendancy. It had nothing to do with any personal matter. These were military ranks. In other royal states, serving in this capacity was a sacred trust before God. That was taken very seriously. The foibles of the Petrograd state pale in comparison to the mass slaughters of the 20th century. And the claim that Rasputin was using any kind of hypnosis, he was vehemently opposed to this kind of thing. Mesmerism, it was called at the time. And he made that clear to interviewers in the past. There is no evidence, none, that he was part of any group or sect that used techniques like that. There was no proof that he was even aware of what these sects were doing and the methods that they were using, assuming that they were even using them. Yes, he was able to calm the Tsarevich during certainly of great importance, but he didn't actually cure Alexei of anything. Through prayer, he was able to soothe his nerves, and he took no credit for anything. He refused to take personal credit for this. And the famous thing is that Alexei was cured of his bleeding disorder, and he used some sort of hypnosis to do this. There's no evidence here. And it kind of blows away the modern mind because no one's quite sure what he did. But Rasputin would agree. He said God only is responsible for this. He sought no reward for anything. And whenever his services were over, he left the palace. He routinely left the company of the royal family. He wanted to go back to Siberia many times. He wasn't in the palace. And only when the royal family pleaded for him to return. that that he went back. And again, as I've written before, this is very curious behavior from someone who was power man. Twice at least, he wanted to leave for Siberia to go back, and because of his influence over Alexei, he remained. He had no political agenda that anyone could notice. Investigated every possible angle here. Now, there was no doubt in Rasputin's mind that there was a cabal in the palace against Alexei. And he did know that his days were numbered. And then you had someone, well, you had at least one incident. You know, Felix Usapov, who was a prince, homosexual, approached Rasputin, asking him to intercede with the royal family for the oldest Romanov's daughter's hand. And he was offered a bribe for this, and he refused. Immediately after that, the story began to circulate, and then Prince Usapov moved to England to avoid any kind of embarrassment. Then he began to circulate stories about Rasputin in the English press. He was an alcoholic. And roughly from 1909 on, the stories about him just got worse and worse and worse over time. They're always looking for something, cherry-picking whatever they could, anything to delegitimize a rapidly growing Russian Empire. And the British press was a big part of it. Which, again, means that the entire early 20th century in Russian history needs to be rewritten. These newspaper articles can never be used as evidence for anything. They were fabricated. And this was a normal way for political issues to be treated. I mean, the investigative committee admits that these were in the Russian and the British press, and these are being used as evidence. Nothing about them can be trusted. And I've written and spoken 100 times that the upper levels of the nobility in Petersburg was liberal at the time. They resented the traditionalism, whether it be of Alexander III or Nicholas II. And any kind of uneducated yokel at court, like Rasputin, got them very upset. And this is something that turned them against traditionalism even more. Now, Rasputin was not uneducated. He has strong peasant roots. But he shows up in the palace only when the Tsarevich needed him, and rarely at any other time. He was not constantly there. He didn't want to be there. The nobility threw its weight behind liberal reform. And the upper reaches of the nobility were turning against Nicholas and even manipulating the church to turn against him. The emperor was surrounded by turncoats and traitors, and each one viewing himself as a future of the new Republican Russia in union with Britain and dedicated to free trade. Nicholas reached a point near the end where Nicholas didn't know who he can trust. And you know, there's so many works talking about the spiritual teachings of Rasputin. He never sought disciples. He never sought students, but he attracted them anyway. Now, again, no evidence that Rasputin was ever a member of any kind of a sect or a cult. But some of his teachings were eccentric in the context of orthodoxy. Works like Neither Devil Nor Saint by Judas, which is one of my favorite books on the topic, doesn't go all the way, but is very important as a way to bring some measure to the attacks on him that are a daily event in history departments. As far as eyewitnesses, as far as solid evidence, you have absolutely nothing. And ultimately, what it comes down to, and Rasputin was a symbol of this, and in the Judas book and in many other places, the peasants were correct. The Tsar was good, the nobility, the nobles, evil. This is a refrain that goes back to the 15th century, and they were not very far off. Even the police were not of one mind. One officer, Anne Prilina, stated that Rasputin was always sober. January 4th, 1910, he wrote. There's a theory that Rasputin was hired to heal the schism with the old believers. The murder of Rasputin was to be the first stage in a revolutionary coup, which is a very common theory. Rasputin was a means to desacralize the monarchy without attacking it directly. Archbishop Ambrose Shurov in 2002 at the Royal Orthodox Conference in Ivanovo on May 18th said, Rasputin suffered many attacks from the enemies of Russia. The press created hatred of the crown so as to cast a shadow on the royal family, which I got from Platonov. That concept comes up in Platonov and elsewhere. But Rasputin tried to get his own son exempted from military service. The Tsar said, no, all must serve. That was probably the most Rasputin ever tried to do. You had three saintly elders at the time, Jerome, Kirill, and Nicholas. Gurionov, Kirill Pavlov, all revered Rasputin for his righteous behavior. But 1909, 1910, the first vicious attacks began. And the organs were Slovo and the Russian word were the two big ones. Mikhailov and Gissin, Venever, and Dologorkis were the big backers of this. And Russian Freemasons in the Revolution, which is an excellent book, strongly implicate the Supreme Council as a major player in the fight against the crown, using Rasputin as their foil. And then Rodzianko, who was a chair of the Duma at the time, admitted that it was this Masonic Congress in Brussels that led him to begin attacking Rasputin. It comes straight out of his memoirs, talking about the role of the lodges in using Rasputin to attack Tsar Nicholas. And there was Russian Baptist J.S. Prokhanov. Russia can proceed. You know, and Rasputin was a very easy person to use and to manipulate. And the absolute, you know, the anti-Rasputin propaganda came from, and then of course there's the question of Ilodor Trufanov, who became a Jewish atheist and worked for the USSR afterwards. He coined the phrase "Holy Devil." And again, never a single witness to any debauchery. And so many of these stories, you had Masonic congresses that were creating these and churning these stories out. But even unfortunately, the great Metropolitan Anthony Krapovitsky accused Rasputin of being a Kalist, which was a small sect, but no evidence was ever offered there. Now, Theophano Poltava, who was considered a critic of Rasputin, his alleged confession in Rasputin and Mystic Debauchery apparently didn't come from him. The confession was typewritten and contained no signature. And the same thing for police reports. All this evidence seems to have no foundation. And so when all this stuff was gathered and presented to Nicholas, he knew that this conspiracy was deep. But even at that point, there was no concept of debauchery or taverns or alcoholism or rape or anything else. There are some, even today in Russia, who see Rasputin was a shield against Masonry and the occult sciences from penetrating the royal court. He was accused of raping Anna Ryabova. Yet her prison medical records show she was a virgin. Again, no money, no bank account, any attempt to dig up, even going to Siberia to dig up dirt on his turned up absolutely nothing. Now, you do have non-Russian historians like Richard Cullen who argue that it was British intelligence that murdered Rasputin, not necessarily a noble cabal. The noble cabal was very much behind it. His book, Rasputin, Torture and Murder, and there's a few others, Count D.M. Grab and N.A. Toffee, tend to agree. Like, for example, they put cyanide in cakes, but apparently cyanide can be neutralized when mixed with glucose, showing general incompetence. You know, there's both noble faction and foreign factions who are at odds with one another. British intelligence definitely played a role here. But of course, his great sin, and probably his only political opinion, was begging Nicholas to stay out of World War I. And so, you know, the most important aspect of all of this that we've been talking about for so many years, and I've made the core of everything that I am, is the context in which these attacks on Rasputin were made known. Why did they need Rasputin? Why did they create these ridiculous stories that had no witnesses and no evidence? Because Russia was one of the most prosperous nations of the era. And I've been a long time since I've dealt with this topic. I'm going to do it now. Imperial Russia built its policy on a, as you see in Russia today, an accumulation of gold reserves. State revenues, 1897, 1.4 billion rubles, without even a slight increase in the tax burden, continued to grow steadily. And state expenditures remained at the same level. 1896, Russia introduced a gold currency. The state bank was granted 300 million rubles in credit. But the government never actually used it, but provided paper circulation. The gold cash more than 100%. By the end of 1914, credit was in circulation for the amount maybe 1.6 billion rubles. The stock of Russia was roughly 1.604 billion rubles. Stability of monetary circulation. So even during the Russo-Japanese War, accompanied by the revolutionary riots inside the country, the exchange of the kind of credit tickets for gold was not suspended. I translated them as credit cards in my book, but these are essentially, you know, paper currency. But as most of you know, what it comes down to is that taxes before the First World War in Russia were the lowest in the world. Direct taxes per inhabitant in 1913 was 3.1 rubles, you know, per capita. It was 10.19 in Austria, 12 in France, 13, 27 in England, and indirect taxes are the same way. The burden of direct taxes in Russia is almost four times less than in France, two times less than in Germany, nine times less than in Britain. This is one of the reasons that they desperately needed to use Rasputin, to have some non-economic, non-political motive or foil to attack the emperor. I mean, savings. I mean, I've been through this, and my first book, The Third Rome, deals with this quite a bit. 1894, 2 million savings accounts were open. 300 million rubles deposited. In 1896, 409 million, and on and on and on. A billion by 1903. Small-scale credit institutions, too. Not just margins. The Russia Yearbook in 1911, and actually the British company put together in 1912. It was one of the most prosperous nations on earth. Coal, iron, sugar production growing by 20% a year. Even in factory level, factory workers, their own welfare was growing tremendous. Special laws were issued to ensure the safety of workers in the mining industry, railways, enterprises that are particularly dangerous, powder plants, etc. Child labor was banned. Juveniles and females couldn't be hired for factory work at night. And any penalty deduction from a worker's salary could not be, couldn't exceed a third of the salary. And it had to be approved by the factory inspector, which is something that Tsar Alexander III had sent to the large factories. The government was involved in every step of this. This was the most advanced social legislation in the world. And it shows you that you can have a growing, more or less modern economy without a lot of modern problems. Most importantly, the agrarian problem was solved. Serfdom was abolished in 1861. Russian peasants received lands that were, you know, had to be forcibly conceded by landlords, but the commune owned the land. But the peasants were the commune, and each one was, of course, completely democratic. And even the peasant move to Siberia. If a peasant wanted to leave European Russia, he had zero taxes for years. Any overpopulation, because the population was exploding, he received a full 15 hectares of land, with about 37 acres per capita, and an allowance of 200 rubles, and transported with all his property at the state expense to any place of settlement. This is how they were going to make Siberia bloom. Government stockpiles, agricultural machinery were put together, agricultural implements, extremely low prices. This is something that the Soviet Union promised but never did. And these implements were let out at very low prices, and it was a huge success. Siberian agriculture exploded. Very few people even talk about this. The state peasant bank bought up landed estates and resold them to peasants on very, very good terms. Your long-term loan was like 90% of the value of the land at very low interest rates, no more than 4.5%. So, of course, by the start of the war, 90% of all arable land in European Russia was in the hand of peasants. And again, as far as Siberia is concerned, about 100 million acres, which were personally owned by Nicholas II, were given to the peasants and given to the Peasant Land Fund. And using their own money, the royal family built schools, churches, hospitals, roads, everything else in these newly settled regions. And this is extraordinary. Having Siberia bloom was actually a reality for a short time. And the state peasant bank, the land bank, was one of the world's largest institutions of credit for peasantry. Very few other places had anything like this. The peasants were not disinherited. They weren't eliminated. And by moving them from parts of European Russia to Siberia, they created an entirely new world that then the white armies during the Civil War were able to take advantage of. The policy was to create peasant land ownership, which was the center of agrarian policy. So you average out by 1918, maybe 5.5 hectares per peasant proprietor. So 14 acres. And even the noble class averaged maybe 2 hectares or 5 acres. Now, as I've written elsewhere, this massive explosion in peasant land ownership, when the Duma government took over, this was a noble class. They wanted this land back. When they talked about expropriating the landowners, they meant peasants. The Duma was a body of landowners and liberal nobles seeking to expropriate peasants for their own gain. This is what they were trying to reverse. When the Reds and even many of the whites are talking about sticking it to the landowners, you think of this very powerful class. There's nothing of the kind. They're talking about peasants. Even the Cossacks in the 15, you got 50 provinces of European Russia. Whether it be peasants and Cossacks, they had a huge percentage, and all other classes in the population owned a relatively small amount. There's no other country that had this. So on the eve of the revolution, February Revolution, it's not crazy to say that peasants own roughly 100% of the arable land in Asian Russia, thanks to the Siberian move, and 90 to 91% of the total area of European Russia. Therefore, revolution was the very last thing on their mind. And what I wrote, and I'm quoting myself here, this was a situation completely unique in the world. This was a traditionalist monarchy that had easily adapted to modernity without losing out economically or morally. It showed that these two things need not be contradictory. Tradition can have the best of both worlds. It showed that modernity is wrong and that technical advancement is not progress as such. It shows that local democracy works, especially when it has a firm religious and national basis. It is a powerful defense of monarchy. And what I mean by that is that this situation, this tremendous prosperity, the growth of every industry, the growth of peasant democracy within the communal system where they're actually owning the land, is itself under a monarchy that they consider absolute. I could go on and on. This is what was destroyed when World War I began. This is what had to be destroyed. Liberalism is of the upper classes. It's always been of the upper classes. So, you know, the war, if you want to overthrow this order, you need war. Germany and Russia were growing very quickly and crowding the British Empire out. As I said 100 times before, getting those two powers to fight each other was the only way that the British could ever continue their global dominion. If World War I never happened, it would be a Germano-Russian universe right now. I can't imagine you would have had mass colonization like you had, you know, with the British ascendancy. I mean, I'm willing to say that given everything I've said, that Royal Russia and Tsar Nicholas is the best run and most just state in the world. An enemy of old Russia, Donald Treadgold, who wrote a classic book, The 20th Century Russia, here's what he says. The years of Nicholas II's reign witnessed the speedy industrial growth, the sweeping transformation of the peasantry into small proprietor, the rapid spread of education, new, diverse, original cultural developments, the schooling of a generation of political thought in the Zemstva, municipalities, the Duma and the courts, and amazing growth of Siberia. The old dynastic absolutism left behind, it was much, the old dynastic absolutism left behind much that it was healthy and promising, with the new totalitarianism stifled and corrupted. And that's on page 121. And the funny thing is, and of course, that goes against everything that he personally believes. He stated a fact there, but ideologically, he can't accept that. That suggests that the strong monarchy under Tsar Nicholas II created all that and oversaw all that and protected all that. Therefore, it can't be a bad thing. Hans Kohn, who I mentioned before, who wrote The Basic History of Modern Russia, one of the worst books I've ever read, said this. By 1914, Russia was successfully on the way to becoming a full partner of the European community. During the decade preceding the revolution, Russia lived through an era of rapidly growing prosperity. Culturally, the fight against illiteracy was started with full vigor, and intellectual and artistic relations with Europe became closer than ever before or since. Now again, as I've written many times, that a description like that starts from kind of false premises. Russia has always been part of the so-called European community. He doesn't mean European, he means the liberal world. You know, St. Vladimir and Yaroslav married into every royal house in Europe. The Byzantine Roman royal house was brought in under Ivan III. Not to mention, you know, Peter the Great and everyone else. He doesn't mean the European cultural scene, he means modern liberalism. The fight against illiteracy has been an ongoing Russian concern. Basil III, Ivan the Terrible, patriarch of the 17th century, made literacy and schooling an essential priority. They're referring to not just liberalism, but the Enlightenment liberal Masonic culture. He's not referring to real culture, which a lot of these people don't know anything about. But even when they're right, these authors are incompetent. So when you have authors, it's, you know, no different than the question on Rasputin. They're right for all the wrong reasons. And when they're right, they don't know how to state it. You had the provisional government admitting that they had no right to exist. Admitting that they're wrong. And nothing seems to come of it. So it gets ignored. And I've quoted two, I could quote 100 more, saying that the monarchy under Tsar Nicholas II was an extraordinary success. This doesn't make any sense, because it can't be. Yet it is. Now, I don't remember if I've ever done a broadcast on this, but along with the prosperity issue, the Rasputin issue, there is the abdication issue. And this has come up recently, too. I want to repeat that Tsar Nicholas never abdicated, nor did he ever resign from office. It's forbidden by law, for one thing. Now, there was a plan that Nicholas had in mind where Prince Michael would take the reins of state while Nicholas maybe would have a spiritual role, to become a spiritual authority, rather than a political authority. Russia was going to be a sacral theocracy with two executives, which, you know, had been the case in the past between, like, for example, Tsar Michael and Patrick Filaret. And that's the view, by the way, of Alexander Nefontov at Kostroma State University. Pavel Milukov, head of the Duma, admitted that Russia was doing way too well for any kind of revolution. This was the problem. This was a problem that liberal revolutionaries based in Belgium and in Britain had. And this is where this is all connected. The attacks on Rasputin, the control of the press, was stymied by the fact that Russia was doing way too well. Rasputin was necessary. They needed to create this mockery to do an end run around the financial domination of Russia throughout the Eastern world. And Russia was winning World War I. So even a fake abdication was possible. Once the war was won, can you imagine the authority that the Tsar would have then? Any revolution would fail. There has to be a way to get rid of Nicholas. People wonder, well, the Allies won World War I, what happened in Russia? This is what happened. Nicholas's generals were among the traitors, many of them exaggerating the violence and chaos throughout the country against him. General Alexeyev was the chief culprit here. And he did see a military dictatorship even for himself. This is the title of the book, A Circle of Betrayal, Cowardice, and Deceit, which comes from Tsar Nicholas's diary. German leaflets flooded the country, saying that the Tsar had promised even more free land. All you had to do was abandon your post and go and get it. Some of them said the Tsar had already abdicated and the war was over. Standard Oil and the Rockefellers tried to take the oil fields in the south, in Baku, and the Tsar said no. This is why the Rockefellers backed the Red Victory, and at some point tilted to Germany near the end. The strength of the monarchy was a thorn in the side of Western capitalists. There was a huge amount of resources, whether it be 1915 or 2020. Huge amount of resources that they saw for themselves. Only a strong state stood in the way. And the Reds would oblige them later on. This is why the capitalists supported the communist movement. So these generals and those around them, as well as the press at the time, created a fake abdication. The letter itself is very dubious. For one thing, it's not on official stationery. Anything that important would be on would be done by the book. But your two generals, Alexeyev and Alexander Lukomsky, said that they actually wrote it, then handed it to the Tsar to sign. But that's not how these things were done, especially by Nicholas. Not to mention the fact that it's typewritten. Royal commands were always handwritten because handwriting is very difficult to forge. Typewritten commands are easy to forge. And it's addressed to the military chief of staff, and he was the only one to receive this letter. It is a very odd method. And importantly, there was no official seal on it, which any one of these is proof of forgery. The signature clearly is fake. There's a signature. It's a tracing. If you look at and in my book, I think I have a picture, and you could find it. Order to the fleet. It's a naval order in 1915, with Nicholas's signature, which is identical. Every curve is copied in detail. It's not copied very well, but it's copied. It's a bad tracing. Clearly not that of Nicholas or someone trying to trace it. And you even have modern Russians and modern mainstream Russians talking about the forgery of the abdication letter. None of the normal protocols of this kind of thing had ever been followed at the time. And Nicholas was a stickler for all of these details. It most certainly was a fraud. And this is how the Allied forces can win a war and have the Russian government, who you would think benefit from it, still be overthrown. Well, it wasn't overthrown. The violence against Nicholas was not that bad. We did not have a mood for revolution. Russia was doing very well in the war, contrary to mythology. There was no supply problems or any of the nonsense like that. And how very few, you know, even specialized historians don't realize that if it's typewritten, it can't be real. And even beyond that, and I forgot to mention, the signature is in pencil, which is banned by royal protocol. And he made it a point to observe this. There was no resignation. There was no abdication. And when the Western press accepted this as true, they knew nothing about the country. They knew nothing about protocols. They knew nothing about how this was done. And they took whatever information they got from the revolutionaries, they took it at face value without a shred of criticism. And this is the this has been the core, really, of my work in Russian history. So now, quoting again from my book on the murder of the royal family, I summed up all of these issues: the blatant lies about Rasputin, the lies about the prosperity of the country, and the lies about this ridiculous abdication. And I say ridiculous, I mean it. That nothing adds up. People accept this stuff as true without even asking basic questions about it. There's a few points that kind of make sense out of all of this. Number one, the Russian state was small. The Russian state was not this tyrannical entity. The number of prisoners was very low, for example. In 1908, you had 56 per 100,000 in prison. In the U.S., it's 750 per 100,000. The number of government workers per 100,000 people was 163. In 2010, it was 1,153 per 100,000 people. That's a massive increase. Another point, when the white state, the Kerensky government, was going to accuse the Tsar of treason, someone said, well, why don't we publish the personal correspondence between Nikolai and the Empress? And they said, no, we can't do this because people will recognize them as saints. Yeah, even people don't realize when Tsar Nicholas issued new uniforms for the army, he wore them personally. He marched 20 miles with a full standard issue pack to see if it were suitable. He was constantly at the front with his son. He was not afraid of death. He was not afraid of injury. Even in the hardest time for the Russian army, the Tsar took over supreme command. While the sovereign headed the army, the enemy was not given a single inch of land. Nicholas's troops did not allow the German army to advance beyond Galicia and western Belarus, despite the fact that I don't think those two should have been enemies in the first place. And you know, when it comes to mobilization, the percentage mobilized during the war in Russia was the lowest. 39% of all men aged 15 to 49 were mobilized. In Germany, it was 81%. In France, it was 79%. England was half. And not to mention, Russian rations were the best in the war. So this nonsense about supplies and this mass discontent simply didn't exist. You had no grounds for revolution here. As I tried to mention before, the ruble, thanks to the monetary reform of 1897, was based on gold. It was the most stable currency in the world. And Count Witte himself said, Russia's gold currency is under the control exclusively of the Emperor Nicholas II. So you had a global economic crisis of 1911-1912, by the way, which Russia weathered with no problem. Russia continued to grow because its currency was under state control. And just like today, Russia's volume of gold reserves was the largest in the world. And you have the most unflinching reserves in the world were in Russia at the time. Very few countries in history can match it. They talk about illiteracy. Well, in 1908, compulsory primary education was introduced. Literacy was 85% by 1916. By the time the war began, you had more than 100 universities. Education spending grew from 25 million to 161 million rubles during Tsar Nicholas's reign. 628% increase in public education. The number of students tripled in 20 years. And of course, it was free at all levels, including universities and technical schools. And it's also spending, relative to this, went up roughly about 300%. 1898, free medical care was introduced for all citizens. And over the 20 years of Tsar Nicholas's rule, the population increased by 62 million. And people don't realize, they talk about supply problems during the war. Russia led the world in both labor productivity and national income. Russia was the world's main producer of most grains and most metals. They didn't have any problems with inflation or unemployment. They were almost completely absent. Per capita alcohol consumption was the second lowest in the world. Only Norway was lower. The growth of the grain harvest went up 200%, while the yield went up 1.5 times. And of course, total freedom of the press, which was a horrible thing for because the journalistic class is so corrupt. And you know, this is a fact that I uncovered. Mental illness per 100,000. 1913, you had 187 people per 100,000 considered mentally ill. After 100 years of life without the monarchy, 5,598 people in 2010 were declared mentally unfit. A rational social life is a part of mental health. The number of suicides per 100,000 people in 1912 is 4.4, proving the same point. It was extremely low. The Russian crime rate was the lowest in the world. There was the International Congress of Criminal Justice in Switzerland. The Russian police were recognized as the best in the world. We've already stated this before. I could go on. The crime rate was, you know, whatever social metric you want. Under Tsar Nicholas, you have the best performance. And it is tiring to hear the constant attacks on him, the constant attacks on Rasputin, the mythology that's taken as fact because a bunch of historians say it. And they say it because it's easy to say it. This is an ongoing problem. And again, everyone, I thank you for listening. This has been a reprise of so much of work that I've done over the past 25 years. I thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.